Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Gregor Robertson is having a deserved few days off, but do not worry, we have very suitable replacements. I'm very delighted to say we have Tom Roddy and Henry Winter joining us for this latest pod. Tom and Henry, great to have you on board. Henry, what have you been up to, and how have you found life under these unusual circumstances?
Hi, Nat. Hi, Tom. Well, I've caught up on some sleep. I've met the family, who seem really nice. I mean, I've spent the last 35 years on the road, so I think they're the ones who are wanting to get rid of me. The kids are very much pushing Project Restart. I think it's just been, I mean, my admiration for the people in the office at the Times has just gone even more through the roof, how they've managed to sort of juggle doing everything, coordinating with people all from their kitchen tables while homeschooling and, you know, just living with a lockdown. But yeah, it's quite a, it's been a fascinating period. I mean, it's one of those, it kind of shows the power of the Times in a way. In that I've had a lot of people come on and say we'd like to do pieces with the Times because of the community schemes they're involved in, or this is agents and players and managers as well. I'm sure Tom's the same. We probably get about 3 or 4 calls a day from people offering up, you know, a chat with a player or themselves or the coaches or clubs or whatever. So I think it's been fascinating, but obviously it's a complete shock to football, a sobering up period with all the financial problems, and also a realization for football that it can't exist in a bubble. There are more significant, important things out there, and the people that we tend to put on a pedestal as sports journalists, i.e. footballers, I think the people who are going to be put on pedestals now in society are going to be nurses and key workers and doctors.
Yes, absolutely. We can only hope for that, that's for sure. Tom, obviously, Henry was there saying that, you know, he's busy, he's getting lots of calls from many different people wanting to work with the Times. How are you finding it? Are you just as busy, or if not more, as a result of what's going on?
Probably more busy, really, but just in different ways, really. I think I found personally the first 2 or 3 weeks were sort of adjusting, trying to work out how we were going to go from there without any sport to cover. But I've enjoyed the work, you know, the retro pieces we've done, yes, dipping into kind of other sports and the stories that we found and that I've read my colleagues writing have been brilliant.
Either of you learnt any new skills, by the way, during this lockdown? Or not had the time?
My skills have probably diminished in the any that I had, probably diminished in this time. But the one I'd never thought I'd say this, but I've actually been doing some gardening, and it doesn't quite substitute the feeling of watching a football match. But when my osteopernum flowered, it did replace it a little bit, the thrill.
And how about you, Henry? Any new skills?
Well, I've never been a big fan of sleep. And I've always, throughout the football season, for sort of 10 months of the season, I've always been fine. Look, 4 to 5.5 hours been absolutely fine. But actually, I've been doing 6-7 hours. I'm feeling a little bit guilty with it.
So you've never been a big fan of sleep? Oh my goodness, I live to sleep.
I'm a fan of sleep, but not oversleeping. I mean, I think, right, you know, if you've got a busy, I mean, Tom will know this, if you've got a busy Champions League week, you're bouncing around all over the place. You might have 3 hours kip after a game, and then you've got an early flight back. You might have an hour's kip on the plane, and then you're on to the next match, and there's a certain rhythm. And you might have a kip in a service station or in a, you know, Anfield or Old Trafford car park before the game. But it's, yeah, sort of 4.5-5 hours is ample. But honestly, I think I had seven hours the other night, and I'm going, this is just such a waste of time.
Oh my goodness, 7 hours to me doesn't sound like enough, but each to their own. Coming up, we're going to look back on some famous on this days in Premier League history. Leicester fans, you won't want to miss that one. And it's time for episode 3 of Unpopular Football Opinion. All that to come after this.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, let's get the very latest then on the Premier League's Project Restart. The back page of the Times today reads, chance to watch every game on TV. Fans may be able to watch almost all 200 remaining matches in the Premier League and the Championship live, with scheduling officials and broadcast partners looking to give as many fixtures as possible a slot. This all, of course, depends on government permission for football to resume, but we could see 3 or 4 Premier League and Championship games screened every day on TV until the end of July. So, Henry, if fans can't attend games, do we think the best solution then is to stagger kickoff times?
Well, it's been quite interesting looking at it, because when the lockdown started and the pandemic really sort of kicked in, government was almost putting the boot into footballers saying you're not doing enough. And now I get the impression that Downing Street is using football to sort of almost control the easing out of this lockdown period. And okay, so the games are at neutral venues, they're all behind closed doors, but I get the impression that the government is almost encouraging football to have all these games scattered across the day, different kickoff times, so that the moment we assume on Sunday that the Prime Minister does announce an easing of lockdown, that everyone doesn't sprint out in the streets, that loads of people will still be watching games. Obviously, that's going to be another sort of couple of, probably the middle of June until the games start coming on again. But I think it's just part of this. You cannot look at what's happening in football without also look at what's happening in Downing Street.
Yeah. I mean, Tom, it's being billed as a feast of football. So do you think it's something that we need?
It's a dream for an armchair fan, really, isn't it? Absolute dream. Super Sunday every single day. I think, as Matt's report said about this, you know, is it's received government backing because of, as Henry said, because they don't want people to be out and about as much as possible. But also there was a nod to the fact they don't want fans congregating outside grounds, outside neutral venues, and I'm not entirely convinced that would be the case, because technology, it wouldn't stop it anyway, because technology today allows you to stand outside the London Stadium or the Amex or Old Trafford and watch a game on your smartphone. But then I'm also not convinced that flat fans would flock to grounds. I mean, the concern is there because of what we saw with PSG at the beginning of March before lockdown came, when the masses of fans were outside the ground. But we're way further down the line from that now. We're way more educated about coronavirus, the dangers involved, and the need for social distancing. So I don't think that's as much of a concern. I think what will be interesting is how the broadcasters actually present these games, how they'll make them appealing to fans at home, to enhance the atmosphere without a crowd there. And there are lots of possibilities being explored there with apps and CGI fans, and that'll really be quite interesting to see how they do it.
Mm. We know obviously they're going to have to take all the necessary medical testing that has to be put in place to ensure that all the footballers are well enough and are negative when it comes to the virus and able to play these games. But Henry, I sort of wondered, do you know or what would you think footballers would think about these staggered kickoff times? Would they be happy with it?
I think their thoughts would be more about health issues rather than timing issues. I think there's an acceptance that, you know, the footballers that I've talked to, you know, there's a frustration that it's going to be behind closed doors, but they accept that. They accept the, you know, the financial imperatives for broadcast and for clubs, and it obviously kicks into their wages, so they understand that. I get the impression when I talk to one or two players that actually the issue is more less about them, but more the fact that they might be living with an elderly relative. They might have someone who's in the, a brother or sister or close relative who's in the same building as them, who is at risk category. So I think those are the concerns, which I think will be articulated increasingly as the time draws near, when players do go back to training, particularly contact training, and then to matches itself. So the players are central to us. Obviously, everything comes down to money and health. Everyone understands that. But the players are right in the middle of that. And I think the clubs still have a little bit of persuading to do with players to convince them completely.
Mm. Well, one of the big talking points from Project Restart is the use of neutral venues with 8 to 10 stadiums deemed to be the best equipped to host sterile matches. Now, Henry, I know you've been speaking to the Aston Villa chief executive, Christian Perslow, about this, with Villa, of course, in the precarious position of 19th place, but crucially with a game in hand that if they won, would actually take them out of the relegation zone. Villa's 7 wins this season, 5 of them have come at home. They have 10 games left, 6 of them are scheduled for Villa Park. So I suppose, Henry, you can't blame Christian Perslow for being against the idea of neutral venues.
You can't. I mean, you know, he's thinking of the Holt End in full cry. Obviously, there are going to be no fans in the ground, but there is still that sort of emotional element of being at Villa Park. The familiarity for the players. You know, if any of them were on edge before a game, they know the route in when they park in that tight car park there with the big fences. The familiar face of the security man there who waves them in walking through, it's familiar, it's home to them, and they don't want to lose that edge. But I think this is driven less by the club, certainly not by the clubs, but actually more by the police. I think the police want to move, say, a potential for Liverpool celebrating a title at Anfield. They want to move that well away from there.
Yeah, so it's a safety aspect from the police wanting these neutral venues involved. And he also talks about the right formula needed to get this season finished. And I'm guessing, Tom, that formula won't be perfect. Not every club is going to be happy necessarily with what is finally decided.
No, I don't believe so. And I think it's actually really great to hear Perslow talking. And I think Villa have been good. Brighton have been great as well. We've heard from Paul Barber, Dan Ashworth, Graham Potter and Glenn Murray. And Barber was actually especially interesting on the topic of neutral venues on Monday. And he's, you know, plenty of people have been talking about what does the difference make, actually, of home advantage with an empty stadium when your fans aren't there. And Barber went into the fact, you know, you've with Brighton in particular, they've got their training pitches are replicated to the Amex pitch. The changing room is exactly the same as the Amex changing room. It's all done for small margins. And of course, they've already played Man City away from home. So they want to have that advantage for their home leg. So they may be small, but there are advantages there. And when you've got the jeopardy of going down, of being relegated, and we, you know, we see what Brighton and those other clubs are different to Sunderland, but we see what happened with Sunderland. It's a trap you really don't want to fall into.
So, Henry, when the Premier League have their meeting on Monday, where they're going to be discussing what's going to be happening next, we're not going to have a unanimous decision on this, are we?
No chance. It's looking very divided. I mean, it's interesting, this whole debate about behind closed doors. But I think a bigger issue going into it is going to be weakened teams, because I think there will be some players inevitably will test positive. They'll have to go into self-isolation. There might be one or two of their teammates, obviously people they've come into contact with. I think you're going to see weakened teams there. I also think once one or two of the sort of major issues in the table are decided, particularly Liverpool getting the 2 wins for the title, I would be surprised if Jurgen Klopp plays a full strength team for his remaining matches once the title is sorted out. I think he'll say to some of his stars, listen, just go and have a break, particularly the lockdown's been eased enough that people can actually, you know, have a sort of proper hot. I mean, they've been talking about players having a holiday, whereas obviously, you know, the last 2 months they've not actually been doing anything. So I personally, I think that's going to be far more of an issue, a live issue when it comes in. You're going to have, it's almost going to be like a League Cup night with weakened teams out there.
It's interesting you mentioned, though, about weakened teams if players do contract the virus. That's something that Christian Perslow has spoken about as well. He says if Villa had to play a match without Grealish, Mings and McGinn, the chances of winning that game would decrease enormously. I'd obviously like a rule that says we don't have to play if our best players had COVID. Is that a rule that you think could really work, Henry?
Well, I think if his best players have got COVID, I think that's it. They're isolating at home, and Dean Smith is going to have to sort of work with the rest of the squad that he's got. I think they're going to have to expand the squads. I think they'll have to be more sort of under 23s in there, particularly as they're going to be playing games in a slightly more intense period. But no, I just think that, look, they are so keen to get these games played. There's the UEFA deadline looking at them. There's BT and Sky. So I think it's going to be a pretty long and probably fairly spiky meeting with teams at the bottom.
Tom, it's really interesting about players possibly testing positive for the virus that they would want a game called off. But that really is only going to, well, have the season ongoing more and more. And the whole aim of this is to try and condense it all down to get it finished as soon as it is possible, surely.
Yeah, completely. You know, who qualifies as their best players? How many players do you get, and who decides it? What if, you know, Villa choose Grealish, Mings and McGinn, as Perslow mentions, but all of Villa's goalkeepers are suddenly sick? But I do think, you know, I think this is actually going to be the next big issue, because if we're talking about small margins with neutral venues, then the possibility of losing those key players are huge disadvantages for a team. But the truth of it is it only really needs on Monday for those 14 teams to agree to go ahead. And I feel like it seems increasingly likely that will happen, that they'll get the support, and then it doesn't particularly matter what people do want or the rules they request as it goes through.
A final thought on this one then, Henry. How close do you think we are to having a plan in place for the return of football?
Well, I mean, all the indications, stories breaking in the last sort of half hour, is that Johnson's going to signal 3 more weeks of lockdown. Obviously, there'll be a slight loosening of it on exercise. Look, he wants to get business back on its feet, but you can't hurry something like this. You know, we've got to wait until, you know, the amazing people in the NHS win their fight, and with the character and expertise they've got, they will win it. But it's not something, football cannot go at its usual breakneck pace. It has to be guided by the medical experts. And I've always said this from the very start, football cannot live inside its own bubble. It's got to sort of move to the rhythm of others in this case, and that is medical science.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, I don't know if you knew this, but the 7th of May has been an interesting date in recent football history. The 7th of May, 2006, for example, Lasagna Gate at Upton Park, as Tottenham lost 2-1 to West Ham to miss out on Champions League football. I'm sure we all remember it. But Spurs blamed a dodgy lasagna, which gave them food poisoning, they say, to their players. And their boss, Martin Yol, was furious that their game was forced to go ahead. Whilst over in North London, Thierry Henry scored a hat-trick against Wigan to pinch fourth spot off Spurs in the Gunners' final game at Highbury. Fast forward to just last year, the 7th of May 2019, Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool conjured one of football's greatest ever comebacks to book their place in the Champions League final after sensationally overturning a 3-0 first leg deficit against Barcelona. But that's not the 7th of May we're most interested in today. We're focusing on the 7th of May 2016. Yes, it's 4 years to the day since Leicester City completed their fairy tale story and lifted the Premier League trophy at the King Power Stadium. Leicester marked the occasion with a 3-1 win over Everton before celebrations erupted on the pitch with unforgettable scenes of the trophy lift serenaded by the opera star Andrea Bocelli, of all people. So let's revisit that unforgettable season. And I'll come to you, Tom, first. When you look back on it, at what point did you start to believe Leicester were going to do this?
To be honest, I'm still in shock with it all. But probably the win at the Etihad, I'd say, which was early February. You know, being, I know it's not the team of now, and it's not the manager of now, but with City. But to be 3-0 up after an hour. They'd beaten Liverpool the week before and Tottenham a few weeks earlier. And of course, that game put them 5 points clear, and City had started it in second behind them. So that was probably the moment, although, as I say, probably up until Wes Morgan's lifting the trophy, I probably still didn't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tremendous season, Henry, and I think we all have such fond memories of it. At what point did it turn from could they to they will for you?
Oh, I still think standing in the tunnel before kickoff, I went and did something for Leicester TV before the kickoff of the celebration match, and still in there, just watching the players running out with huge smiles on their faces. I was still in disbelief. I mean, they were celebrating. I think possibly it sank in just the extraordinary nature of what they've done. When you see a world superstar like Andrea Bocelli on stage singing so beautifully like that, and how much it meant for Claudio Ranieri. I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. So it was, you know, that was an emotional occasion. But I would probably say then, only then, actually watching the players with a smile on their faces. Obviously, we still remember the images of them celebrating in Jamie Vardy's kitchen. So I still think then, but I agree with Tom. I mean, it's still, looking back on it, and when people have done all these retro pieces, I mean, I still find it incredible what they did.
And Tom, you listed off some of their great victories. Is there one that particularly stands out as a key moment?
There was, you know, the teams they beat that year. They beat Chelsea, City, Spurs. I mean, I remember that Chelsea game was when Mourinho was on the way out. I think it was the one before Mourinho's last game. So it wasn't hugely surprising. But Spurs, and I go back to that City game, to be honest, as the standout one, because to do that at the Etihad and the context of those games around it, I think that was the standout moment.
Yeah. And Henry, obviously, you mentioned Claudio Ranieri there. He was lifting the trophy come the 7th of May 2016. How much credit does he deserve in leading Leicester to the title?
I mean, a fair amount of credit, but I think this is very much one, the power and the force of that dressing room, the spine of the team. And you look at people like Kasper Schmeichel and Wes Morgan going through to Jamie Vardy at the front. You know, they're really strong individuals in that team. And you still see it now when you see some of them gathered together, there's a real close bond in there. And these are not just really good footballers, very good at their jobs. These are really bright, driven individuals. And don't underestimate Jamie Vardy's, just almost the way he shaped that team and how Drinkwater would play those balls to him. Look, Ranieri was brilliant in terms of dealing with the media, taking the pressure off the team, keeping everything calm. Everything was dilly ding, dilly dong, and all that. And it was all nice and this slightly homespun thing. And no, it can't happen, and whatever. But, you know, obviously, look, he's Italian. He knows how to organise a team, make them defensively strong. And yes, he did all that. But I say this is as much a triumph for Ranieri, one of the nicest men you can meet in the world, let alone football. I think this was a triumph for the dressing room, for strong players.
And what about Nigel Pearson? Does he deserve any praise as well?
I know Nigel well, and I mean, it was, you know, the work that he did, the great escape, a lot of the team that he put together. I thought it was very good to hear, and the celebrations, the players praised the work that Nigel Pearce had done. But yeah, absolutely, Nigel Pearson definitely deserves praise.
Henry's listed there some of the players involved in that season, Tom. Who do you think was their most influential?
God, I think that's one of the hardest questions probably to answer. I don't think there were. I don't think it would have happened without each of the key sort of protagonists. I mean, you've got Kante, and you see what he's gone on to do, and what a bargain he was, but what he's gone on to do and how important he was for the for Chelsea's team under Antonio Conte the following year. I mean, that shows how important he was. And then you've got this the style that Leicester played with counter-attacking football. I mean, could they have done that without Jamie Vardy? I don't think so. And then the leadership, I think Wes Morgan sometimes gets a little bit forgotten about because of the way Kante, Vardy, Mahrez, all those players are still around. But Wes Morgan's leadership was so key. But I think if I was to have to pick one, it probably would be Mahrez. I think he linked everything up. No one could handle him that year either. You think of players like Iron Robin, where they're you know how they're going to play. You know he's going to be on his left foot, but there was nothing they could do about it. and it was no surprise that he won PFA Player of the Year that year.
Yeah, it was a collective effort, obviously, for Leicester. But who stood out for you, Henry?
Do you know what? I would actually say it was one particular trait that stood out for me. If I think of them, the players in the Leicester City dressing room that won the title, I actually think of their humour. I mean, they're really funny guys. You talk to Kasper Schmeichel, you've talked to Kasper. He's a really funny, amusing, entertaining guy. Robert Huth, Danny Simpson, Fuchs, Jamie Vardy. There were some real characters in that dressing room. You've got Wes Morgan as well. And you could just see that there were just almost a sort of brotherhood. There was humour there. They enjoyed each other's company. You saw it when they went on that Christmas fancy dress on. They were dressing up as Ninja Turtles and things like that. And it was kind of, you know, they were just a bunch of sort of footballing students in a way, just sort of happy and, you know, they, obviously winners, competitive edge, technical, tactical, they had all that. But I think there was also, if I think of the quality that I most associate with that Leicester City dressing room, is they liked to laugh and they enjoyed each other's company.
Yeah, certainly so. The problem is, though, Tom, unfortunately, when there's a shock like this was, people often say, well, that's because the traditional big sides were a bit of a disappointment that season. How did Leicester do it? Was it because other sides failed? Or actually, were they just the better team that season overall?
I think it was a bit of both, probably. I mean, they were outstanding that year. And it's just an incredible story. At the same time, you know, United were still drifting and drifting. It was Chelsea's big capitulation under Mourinho, where they were in the relegation zone. We all knew at City that Pellegrini was on his way out and Guardiola was on the way in. And Liverpool, Klopp was what, a year into his work then? And it was far from finished. So I think it was a little bit of both. It was opportunism and really, you know, Tottenham look back on that year and feel they should have done it. And they probably should have done.
Do you think we'll ever see a similar story in the Premier League again, Henry?
Oh, do you think we'll see football? I mean, you've got to ask that at the moment.
Fair enough, yes.
So, you know, let's go step by step. Let's get football back, let's get fans back, and then let's get fairy tales back. Yeah, I absolutely can see it again, because that's the joy of football. No one, you know, I mean, I've got friends who work for a local paper who were writing books, you know, the 5,000-to-1 miracle. And you see them now, and they still can't believe it. But why can't that? And that's the beauty of sport, and the reason why we follow it, the tales of the unexpected, that can happen. It can happen again. I think it will be more difficult now, because as Tom so eloquently proven, there was a sort of slight gap. Arsenal will be kicking themselves. Tottenham, the meltdown at Chelsea. You know, Liverpool and Manchester City and Manchester United were at different parts of their development. So it was the perfect storm that helped Leicester City. But, you know, it might happen again. Why not? Look at Sheffield United this season. Why can't they kick on again next season, whenever the next season is?
So for you, Tom, if you have to think of all your underdog stories in football, is this the one? Is this the greatest that you've ever known of?
I think it is. I mean, in terms of underdog stories, the Greece in 2004 kind of comes to mind. I mean, who would have predicted that at the beginning of the tournament, when you've got Ronaldo's Portugal and France with Zidane, Henri, Makalele, Vieira, and even, you know, England as well. What a team that was, with Rooney, Owen, Gerrard, Lampard. And I think the problem, though, is that the model of the Premier League, it often, the pyramid often ends up the way you predict because of the way money is invested and the wages and transfers that clubs can afford. I mean, that was the year that City bought Sterling. De Bruyne came from Wolfsburg. I think Liverpool spent 30 million on Benteke that year. So it just totally went against the odds. So yeah, absolutely. It's the greatest underdog story.
Is that the same for you, Henry?
I mean, I would definitely look at Wimbledon in the Cup when they won that against Liverpool. That was an extraordinary story. I mean, look, Wimbledon were having a good league season at the time. I think that, but obviously Cup's different. That to actually sustain something like Leicester did over the league, over the whole season, was phenomenal. So, yeah, I think it would be the number one.
Okay, before we end, we need to get both Henry and Tom involved in our new feature on this podcast called the Unpopular Football Opinions. It all started when podcast regular Jonathan Northcroft claimed that England have overachieved as a football team because their players have never actually been that good. His fellow Scotsman Gregor Robertson then twisted the knife by adding that England haven't produced a top manager since Sir Bobby Robson. So you can see that I was very ganged up on by those naughty Scotsmen. But I also got involved by calling out entitled football fans who think that just because their club has a history of winning trophies and even a large fan base, they belong in the top flight. That was a sample then of our unpopular opinions. And thankfully, it's a far less tartan feel to today's podcast. But before we get on to your own opinions, what did you make of those three unpopular football opinions I've just mentioned there, Henry? Do you agree with any of them?
Well, I mean, the point about England never having had a top team is nonsense. I think if you look at No, but seriously, I mean, you just look at dispassionately, you just look at 1966 and you look at 1970. Yes. So I think for that period, England were the best team in the world. Clearly won the World Cup. Okay, so it was on home ground. But you just look at the players in that. I mean, these are phenomenal players who were contesting Ballon d'Ors. I mean, Sir Bobby Charlton won the Ballon d'Or and was runner-up the following 2 years. So that shows a period of sustained excellence. In terms of, you look at the other players in that team. I mean, if you're saying that they weren't a great team, that the whole point about 66 is that they were a fantastic team. They were 11 players, you know, 12 players, obviously, with Greaves earlier. And they really bonded. They were good players who became a great team. 1970, as everyone says, I think obviously I wasn't there. I was quite young at the time. 1970, they had arguably a better squad. So I think that's just nonsense.
Okay, so Jonathan Northcroft, that is an unpopular opinion from him. Tom, did any of the ones I've just mentioned stand out for you?
Well, I'd like to see Johnny's mentions on Twitter since last
yes.
week.
We did advise him to steer clear.
The mute button would have been come in handy, I'm sure. I mean, to be honest, actually watching the on television, what I've actually enjoyed during lockdown is watching the not massively retro games, but even sort of 10, 15 years ago, and being reminded of the quality of that England side and how much potential was actually there and how poorly it was used. I think there was a lot more. They were much better than and could have done so much more than they did. And we all know why you were picking on Leeds now, don't we?
No, I made a point of saying it wasn't an anti-Leeds thing, but I did use them as an example, but it wasn't an anti-Leeds opinion, that's for sure. But obviously, we've got to get to both of your unpopular football opinions. Let me just give you this bit of advice. Make sure they aren't too safe, as our referee Tom Clark from The Times is listening and has already called Gregor Robertson out for his so-called unpopular opinion that the Championship is more entertaining than the Premier League. That might have something to do with the fact that Tom Clark is a fan of Lincoln, so may have a bias towards the EFL, but I did agree with Gregor as well, so maybe not that unpopular. So, Tom, should we start with you? What's your unpopular opinion in football?
I'm going to go with... there's nothing wrong with half and half scarves.
Oh.
In fact, I actually quite like them. I think they mark an occasion. I think they look great outside grounds. And I think I've got friends. I'm based down in the south, and I've got friends who are fans of clubs up north, and they don't get to go to. And the reason they're fans of clubs up north is because of their parents, and they don't get to go to as many games as they'd like to. So I think for those people, those scarves are great. And yes, I'll be turning off my mentions too.
Do you have any half and half scarves, Tom?
I don't actually. I say that, but I don't. I don't have any.
Henry, is there a place for half and half scarves?
Yeah, there is a place for half and half scarves. It's in the recycling bin. The whole point, I have many reasons for loathing them, particularly when I saw an England-Germany half and half scarf.
Oh, no,
But the real reason I loathe them is because, as everyone says, they're for tourists. Now, if you want to go to a game and you want a souvenir of a game, buy a programme. Because if you buy a programme, first the money goes into the club, and also it gives a chance for young journalists, because that's where quite a few journalists have started out, doing small pieces for the local programme. So if you're into half and half scarves, you can't be into journalism.
Oh, Tom! Oh, my goodness. On the Times podcast, you have been outed as a terrible journalist, basically.
Tom's a really good journalist. I understand why he's gone half and half scarves, but I do think they are. If I often go into ground slightly mischievously and just take a picture of a half and half scarf and post it, and all I get back is people doing the vomit emoji.
That's why it's an unpopular opinion.
It is.
There you go.
It certainly is, and I think Tom Clark will be happy with you, Tom, for that. Henry, go on then.
Wembley. I think it's a waste of money. I don't think we needed to build it. We don't need a national home for football. We need a national football centre, which cost a fifth of Wembley at St George's Park. It's absolutely important, which is where it's developing players and coaches. But we don't need a national stadium. We've got a fantastic stadium all over the countries where we could play games. So I find it fairly soulless. I just don't see the point of it. I was so pleased when the FA almost sold it, because they could have used the money for it into grassroots. They almost sold it. They should have done, and they rather naively gave the vote to the FA council, to the sort of effectively the counties and the shires, and they love their days out at Wembley, when they could have used that money to pour into grassroots football, and maybe we wouldn't be staring quite so deeply into the abyss as we are at the moment.
I mean, I do like the idea of an England roadshow, so taking it around Absolutely. The country. Tom, what do you think? Is Wembley not needed?
I completely agree with both of you on the idea of seeing England playing around the country. I think it's good to have the home home of football, and I like, you know, seeing different events there. It's a great place, and it's an impressive place. But I do actually agree with Henry on the soulless fact. I don't feel like it's much of a fortress for any, you know, countries coming to play England.
Come on, Tom, tell us, have you got a Wembley Twickenham half and half scarf?
Oh my goodness, that's the next thing you can come up with. But Henry, do you base your opinion on the new Wembley, because maybe you look nostalgically back at the old Wembley?
No, I hated the old Wembley.
Oh, really?
It was, yeah. I mean, some of the staff there were, I mean, they were notorious. I mean, people, you know, cricket people sort of talk about, you know, the old gate and the whatever it was, the Grace Gates at Lord's, but they weren't a patch on Wembley. Wembley, the pitch wasn't as great as everyone said. Obviously, there was the Horse of the Year show. Look, it had the history and all that, but we have got an amazing array of stadia in this country where you could hold games. And the moment they moved semi-finals to Wembley, away from Villa Park or Trafford places like that, you know, the FA Cup took a hit. So I know loads of people love Wembley. I know they love going there. I know they love getting their half and half scarves outside. But the England national team belongs in the north. It belongs in the south. It belongs all over. It doesn't belong on a pitch attached to a car parking lot in northwest London.
But what about, just finally then, you've mentioned a little bit about the FA Cup and the League Cup. Do they belong at Wembley?
You know, we're talking about money filtering into the game. Let's play it elsewhere. You know, we often have this sort of ridiculous thing, particularly when they've moved the FA Cup final to early evening, that if you've got two clubs from the north, how are they going to get back? I think it's offensive towards fans. I really enjoyed having the final in Cardiff. Cardiff is a ground, the Millennium, which is built with fans in mind. It's close to the pitch. It's got a fantastic atmosphere, five times the atmosphere of Wembley. So, look, I know it's an unpopular opinion. I know many people love Wembley, but for me, it is just, it's a white elephant.
Do you know what? I think both of you are going to be in the good books for Tom Clark. I think he's going to like your unpopular opinions. And that is it for now. Many thanks to Tom and to Henry as well. You may find yourself with more time on your hands in the coming week. So do remember you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's only £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we will be back with you on Monday for the very latest game podcast. Stay safe in the meantime.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.